what we had come up with to date was that a person becomes a patient at the point that they are being cared for in a facility. Being cared for includes clinical assessment or engagement by a member of the care team and or receiving therapeutic care with the intent to diagnose or treat. And that's as close as we've been able to come to that. But we wanted to acknowledge some of these ideas of, you know, the person who is there but hasn't been seen, hasn't been assessed, nobody has had any contact with that person at all, and it may or may not have really been a preventable event, but it probably falls more into the category of not preventable. And I agree that that definition might work in a hospital setting or in a clinic, and it may not work elsewhere, but it's a start.
That does seem helpful.
Of course, we still haven't figured out when someone is no longer a patient. That's the other side of this. At what point is your responsibility for that patient ended? Is it when they are discharged, but they haven't yet left the facility? Is it when you put them in their car to go home? At what point do you give up that responsibility for that patient? We don't have an answer for that one yet.
Doesn't that have to do with monitoring? Right, if you are done monitoring them.
Yes, although we've run into some gray areas even there. We've had cases where, you know, someone is discharged, but then they're going down to the pharmacy to pick up a prescription before they leave. There are some facilities that have patients in kind of a holding area before they actually go home, although they've technically been discharged. There were a few more gray areas there than we thought there would be, and we haven't yet been able to come up with a really clear definition. But yeah, I think that's kind of the gist of what it needs to be.
Yeah, I don't think we'll solve this by describing the geography more precisely. I for me, it's sort of one of those quasi-legal definitions of custody or responsibility or, you know, some sort of reliance upon you to assure their safety during a certain process, which really has a beginning and an end.
I don't know if we're going to get to the beginning and the end in this definition. It does, there still seems to be some ambiguity around both of those points.
It seems like a continuum in a hospital. You'd want to have the care being overseen and carefully enough so that a suicide wouldn't be would be a serious reportable event. But as you get further out in terms of ambulatory care, it strikes me as being a little less. It gets into the almost a diagnostic an issue that would be much more difficult to control. So,
well, you
on
know,
the other hand, if you have a death as a result of a suicide, I don't know, maybe something that someone want to go back and look at and see, is there some way we could prevent that from happening again? Did we miss something? I'm having trouble coming to a conclusion on this one myself.
For me, the most pragmatic draconian solution is to just exclude the office environment and just say, yeah, by facility, we really mean facility.
Yeah, I'm kind of...
I mean, I do think this is pretty relevant in the office environment when you, you know, identify a patient who may be at suicide risk and you're making phone calls, and if they take off and do something while, I mean, again, they're in the care at that point.
Well, I'm not denying that it's incredibly relevant. I still have scars from a wrestling match I had with a patient in my office with a knife. But it may be that we would sacrifice the data collection just because it's very hard to tell people what the boundaries are when we're talking about the office.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the Joint Commission Sentinel event reports, and suicide continues, well, now it's second to surgery in terms of the percent of total events reported voluntarily. But in continues to go up as an issue. Now, this doesn't show the setting where these events have occurred, but it's not a problem that's resolving. So the issue of expanding it to multiple settings, I don't know. I think you do run into the question of the preventability of it and whether or not you even knew the patient had these thoughts once you get into the ambulatory area.
We've actually had that issue. This is Cynthia in the inpatient setting as well, where they came in for some non-psychological reason with no history of any kind of psych or suicide, and for whatever reason that nobody knew about, were bound and determined to kill themselves.
I'd also like to point out that our reporting threshold here is serious injury. And if a patient swallows 9,000 Elavil while they're in ICU in an attempted suicide, and we pump their stomach right away, this wouldn't be reportable.
I feel the need to move forward, but we're not certainly on any consensus on this because of both the decision about healthcare settings and the serious disability harm, et cetera, whatever. Can we report this as it is with the various notes given about the extenuating circumstances or whatever other descriptive notes that people have included here, the TAP. I'm not even sure we're at the decision point for SurveyMonkey being that helpful here because there seems to be such a lot of discussion around it. I don't know.
Well, this is Peter. A bit more specificity would certainly be helpful. As we develop a report and try to put that up for public comment, to have all sorts of caveats in any one of these SREs is probably going to be a little bit more confusing rather than helpful to the community, and a default position might be to just leave it as it is. I'm not suggesting that's the way to go, but this is a set of language to some degree the healthcare community already has become accustomed to. And in our efforts to refine and to make it better, if we're actually making it worse, then sometimes it's better to leave well enough alone.
Yeah, and I would tend to agree with that. This is one that I'm surprised that we've had so much discussion about because I always thought this one was pretty straightforward. I worry a little bit that some of the things we're talking about do muddy the waters and lose sight a little bit of what it is that we're trying to capture, which I think is already fairly succinctly captured in the existing event.
Yeah, this may be an example of the great getting in the way of the good.
How about we report it as is, leave it as is, and then people on this committee or otherwise who have strong thoughts or feelings can weigh in at the public comment period. Will that work?
Yes.
Leave it as? Okay.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Let's move. These are the care management events. Patient death or serious disability associated with medication error.
I'm sure there'll be no discussion on this, right?
Well, this is the one where before I ended up leaving for the trip, I had raised a comment about the patient whether we should include patient activities in the description.
This is Peter Angott again. Similar to my last comments for the previous discussion, I would sort of reflect that for this one as well. I think it would get pretty murky pretty quick if we tried to bring in the whole issue of patient compliance with medication usage. on this particular issue. That's not to say it's not critically important, and it certainly does impact outcomes, but it would be difficult, I think, to put it in a serious and reportable event type of category. That's word of caution.
Our physician office staff agreed that we should exclude the adherence issues for now, just because, as you said, it would just be too challenging. And so our only other suggestion was really to kind of expand the examples to be more relevant to ambulatory as well. But and we actually agreed with some of the skilled nursing facility recommendations around failure to monitor as well.
And this is a tough one in the long-term care environment as we continue to move toward more patient autonomy and the use of their own medications and keeping them at hand. With regards to the serious disabilities associated with self-medication, we're a little bit safe that way. But we had a number of caveats for this one. And if it's to be used in the reporting for skilled facilities, we think it does require a lot of caveats.
This is Michael. Bringing in the comments that we got, very extensive comments regarding essentially what to me were contraindications, I would like to go down to the paragraph that's existing that reads, includes administration to which patient has known allergy and interactions and so on, that whole little thing. And I would like to rewrite that. To simplify it, saying includes administration of medication for which there is a serious contraindication.
Anything else, folks? Okay.
I suspect we're running out of steam, and we've still got big issues to go. And
yeah, you do.
Just so I know, do we have a public comment that we need to include today?
We're going to break for that to see. I don't know if there are going to be any, but we do need to leave time for that.
All
you're
right.
So we definitely need to, you know, we have another, you know, 12 minutes, I'd say, to go in discussion. So
okay.
That's where we are.
There may be others that have 11 o'clock appointments like I do that I have to leave maybe about 5 minutes before the top of the hour.
And this is, well, I'm going to have to leave in about 5 minutes. You know.
Well, it's Peter Angud. I think, you know, we do have a fair amount still to cover, so it's fairly clear we'll need a third phone call to try and wrap up loose ends. But I would encourage you, you know, see what you can plow through over the next 10 minutes, and we'll make room for public comment as best. But typically those have been fairly quick.
Okay, on this one, can we report that one as is and make some notes on exclusions, inclusions, contraindication, what people's thoughts on. But reporting as is okay?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, let's move to patient death or serious disability. Again.
So physician office, we agreed with it as is.
And this is incompatible blood or blood products. Sorry.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In skilled care, this happens infrequently, but we wanted it included.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this sounds like we have less controversy here. Entirely preventable, should be across all healthcare settings. Any other thoughts on this to the contrary? Okay. Sounds like we're in agreement on that one. So let's move. Next one. Okay, maternal death or disability associated with labor, delivery, and low-risk pregnancy while being cared for in a healthcare facility.
Physician office, we didn't think it was relevant to us because we were not considering things like birthing centers or those kinds of places.
And not in the nursing home either.
Are we comfortable with the exclusions?
Is there agreement on what constitutes a low-risk pregnancy?
That's pretty well medically defined.
Defined, okay.
My only question, I don't have trouble with the exclusions, although... Well, actually, I take it back. I do have trouble with the exclusions. I don't see why we need any exclusions here if it's a low-risk pregnancy. And why would we exclude emboli? Because that's interesting. You know, your health department would report that. So, but the thing I really wanted to say was, who's in charge of freestanding birthing centers? You know, how many of those still exist?
Well, they only just became licensed in Minnesota. We don't have any yet, but will soon.
Well, we've had them for 15 years here or more in Colorado, but I just don't know if there are any that still survive. But at any rate, I would want to make sure that freestanding birthing centers came under this reporting requirement, because this is exactly made for them.
Mm-hmm. It looks like the office-based surgery TAP did include that as well, that they wanted to include those birthing centers.
Right. That's what I'm looking at, it looks like. So that would be captured under the... the office-based surgery, right? Or ambulatory.
If it is, then I would just say let's accept it as it is with an asterisk on these exclusions, where we may want to talk to some experts about whether we really want to keep them.
Yeah, I can't. Again, I'm certainly not a maternal and child health expert. I can't think of any reason why we would want to exclude any maternal deaths in low-risk pregnancies.
This is Tejal. I agree. Sally, I'll be signing off.
Okay. Thank you, Tejal. We'll get back to you on a further call.
Thank you.
Do we have any consensus, it sounds like, on knocking out a couple of those settings? So it definitely only applies in the one setting that we've been discussing as enough to capture it. And are you all suggesting actually deleting the language about exclusion or just putting an asterisk there?
I would propose deleting and then let people argue.
What would an asterisk do?
It would mean we were going to talk about deleting it.
Well, in the interest of time on this call, I think that's fine.
An asterisk, meaning we would discuss possible deletion of it?
Okay.
I think the point of them there is that these things are not known prior, so you could be low risk but get any of those.
Mm-hmm.
And are not preventable necessarily at this point in time.
Now, I have another asterisk here, which is planned home birth. And I know that may be an area where we don't want to reach, but in Colorado... those are definitely reportable and of extreme interest to the obstetrical community. Because they're legal and we have doctors that are supervising or at least cooperating with lay midwives doing them, but we're extremely interested in knowing what their outcomes are.
As we continue and hopefully finish up discussion on this item, Lindsay, my screen has gone out again from your side, I think. Can you make sure that the screen comes up again?
Okay.
Great. Thank you. Thanks. Yep. Okay. Can we report this one as it is? With the settings that have been recommended. And then, again, for the interest of time, putting an asterisk next to any exclusions for so that we will have further discussion and decision on those. Okay, I hear no objection to that, so let's move. Hypoglycemia, is that the next one, I believe? What were the TAP recommendations?
TAP thought this was appropriate for us. There are some caveats with regards to the monitoring, we have to be careful about terminal care and what goes on with that particular population, but otherwise it's a very appropriate.
And I would just have a question or comment. That refusal of monitoring, that's something that in some ways has come up with pressure ulcers as well. Patients who declined to participate in activities that would reduce their risk for a pressure ulcer, as has the end of life / Kennedy ulcer issue arisen for us. And so I guess I would encourage the committee to talk a little bit about that. And my gut reaction to having an exclusion related to patient refusal of monitoring would be that we wouldn't want to go down that road. But I'd be interested to hear what the group thinks about that.
Well, the other side of the coin on this and pressure ulcers, when we eventually get to it, is that people are using hospice care as a free pass, I think I've said this before, as a free pass out of doing the things that might be appropriate. And it could even apply to someone convincing somebody that they didn't want their sugar measured or monitored, just like they, like we come up with regards to, gee, this pressure ulcer is a sign of a terminal event, and therefore
right.
hospice
right.
is appropriate.
Yep.
I guess my vote would be to skirt that problem for now because it gets into such a nuanced discussion that it really interferes with what I see as an extremely narrow and fairly rare event of an insulin overdose.
Yeah. So when you say skirt it, you would not include it as a caveat? Or just so I'm clear.
Well, yeah, the entire discussion about does this include voluntary refusal of monitoring in cases where that refusal was felt to be reasonable or maybe not quite so reasonable, but we went along with it, and so on. You know, let me suggest something draconian here, that this really amounts to a drug overdose. You know, except for pancreatic islet cell tumor, insulinoma, this absolutely falls under the previous one that says wrong drug, wrong dose, wrong something. Why do we even need this?
I think I agree with that, unless you want to highlight that as a specific event. The other thing is this whole business of tight glycemic control, which has been highly debated, and that issue, it technically does fall into a drug dosing error issue. So unless we wanted to call attention to hypoglycemia, and
if we wrapped it in as you're suggesting, that way we can be more elegant in the other drug overdoses as well, and highlight the other high alert medicines. The narcotics, the anticoagulants, et cetera.
Yeah, high-risk medicines.
Yep.
Yeah, insulin's no different from anticoagulant. And here, again, we have a reporting threshold, which is you really hurt them. You know, this wasn't a blood sugar of 80 and they felt dizzy. Here, in this case, you kill their brain cells.
So let me make sure I know what I'm hearing. There is consensus that the hypoglycemia is... could be subsumed by because it's included in the medication error one?
And if we put
overdose?
Additional language in the medication error, such as hypoglycemia in there that would add further clarity. We want it in the other one.
I'd support that.
Okay.
Yeah,
it sounds like there is consensus there. From the staff perspective, does anyone know if there was a reason why hypoglycemia was chiseled out there that wouldn't be covered if it were under a medication error, as long as we had some descriptive language?
Yeah, it's Peter Angood. I don't have the personal perspective on that one myself. I know at the time of origination of a lot of these, the appropriate control of glucose for several disease states was high profile, but the way this is written, it's very much focused on low sugar, and that usually is a result of insulin administration, et cetera, or the lack of recognizing someone with that disease state. But Melinda, do you have comment on its origin, if you remember?
I do not, because this was first introduced in the 2002 edition, which was prior to any involvement that I had with
okay.
it.
Okay. Well, it sounds like this one, let's knock it out and put some more descriptive language in the medication error so that will be inclusive of hypoglycemia as well. And when people comment, if there's some reason that it should be pulled out, I guess people will alert us to that at that time.
Yeah.
I don't think we have time to move forward on any further recommendations because we now should see if there's any public comment, I think, and then figure out what we're going to do about a next call.
Sounds good. Thank you. So, operator, if you could see if there's anyone on our public comment line and then request to see if there are any questions or comments from them.
All lines on the call are open. No additional lines joined.
Okay. So there's nobody who are not members of the steering committee and who are representing other organizations?
Correct.
Okay. So we have no public comment for this meeting. And I would suggest that in terms of doing a third conference call and cleanup, we will, by SurveyMonkey, distribute some possible dates and times. We recognize that at this time of the year, fresh after Labor Day, it will be complicated because of everyone's busy schedule trying to catch up and get back to normal routines. But if you can be flexible, that would be terrific. I would say probably a schedule for a two-hour call would be enough, but I'll ask Melinda and Lindsay's opinion on that as well. A three-hour block on your schedule is always daunting to stick in there, but we may be able to get most work done in 2 hours. Melinda, do you need more from your perspective?
I was just trying to quickly count how many are remaining for the group to consider. So it's really their feeling about how much discussion or controversy there are with respect to the remainder of them. So might be able to plow through in 2 hours. I'm just thinking about what has happened thus far. And for the group to really fully discuss them, they may need three.
Well, this is Eric. I don't think we've hit the big ones yet.
Well, and we've
we
got
know
some
we
definitions
have,
to discuss,
right,
too.
We have falls and pressure ulcers and criminal events
right.
to get to.
Yeah,
right?
I think pressure ulcers is going to probably be an hour on its own.
Yeah, all righty. Well,
and we
I
have the
trying.
New one that Cynthia and I worked on. I like the idea of a two-hour block, but I really don't think that one will be enough.
Yeah.
Maybe
okay,
multiple
we'll
2 hour ones as opposed to one bolus three. I don't know. You tend to get kind of fatigued anyway.
Well, by 2 hours, everybody does lose some steam there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's we'll work the
logistics.
We'll work the logistics. Just look for those requests to come through in your email trails and try to be flexible with us. Either way, we got to knock it off. We can't just sort of stop and ignore it and move on.
No, we've got to keep up.
Yeah, and this is a high-profile program, and your guys' input so far have been very, very valuable. I've always been impressed at the depth and breadth of the discussion, so thank you for that. But let's wrap it up today. We'll send out the schedule notices, and we'll get you summary notes from today's call as well. So I'll turn it back to you, Sally, for any other parting comments or any other dialogue you want to have.
Yeah, thank you for your participation again today. It's been great. It's been helpful. We've gotten most of the way there, but, yeah, we've got some important work to continue doing. So We look forward to very shortly getting from the staff the recap of today, but also the survey instrument so that we can weigh in for when we'll schedule these next call or calls, however that we decide to break that down. And I hope all of you can participate in the next one as well. So thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, terrific. Thank you, everybody. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you.
That does conclude today's call. Thank you for your participation.